and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Tuesday, April 16. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, the headline is, Iowa lawmakers vote to regulate traffic cameras. This story is by Aaron Murphy for the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Automated traffic enforcement cameras would not be banned in Iowa, but they would be regulated and their use limited under legislation receiving final approval from lawmakers Monday. The legislation, which requires local authorities to receive a permit from the state to place a traffic camera and stipulates how local governments would be required to spend revenues from tickets, needs only Governor Kim Reynolds' signature to become law. That a traffic camera bill is headed to Reynolds' desk is a significant development, where previous legislative attempts, mostly to ban the devices, over the course of multiple years have failed. But momentum for addressing traffic cameras built during this year's session is more than devices have cropped up across Iowa. This has been a long time coming. I think 5 or 6 years we've debated this, Senator Tony Bisignano, a Democrat from Des Moines, said Monday during debate in the Senate. We were in such a tie-down, a ban or no ban, that this came to make sense. There is a need for automated traffic cameras, especially in the urban areas. As of January, the state's nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency, which provides statistical analysis for the Iowa legislature, found 25 cities in Iowa with automated traffic enforcement cameras operated in 2023. The agency was able to obtain data on traffic camera usage in 10 of those cities, including Cedar Rapids. Cedar Rapids had 19 traffic cameras, including at 4 locations around the S-curve on Interstate 380, operating in fiscal 2023, according to the agency. The city issued nearly 170,000 citations and collected fines on 55% of those, producing $7.2 million in revenue, according to the analysis, far more than the other cities measured, including Des Moines. According to data from the city of Cedar Rapids, the per-month average of total crashes and crashes with an injury in the city have fallen since the traffic cameras were implemented there in 2010. Marion began operating automated traffic cameras at 2 locations in 2023, and University Heights said it was installing them at 2 locations this year. Iowa's 377 traffic deaths in 2023 were the state's most since 2016, and the state's 11.2% increase in vehicle-related deaths from 2022 to 2023 was the nation's 4th highest, according to a recent federal report. Under the approved legislation, House File 2681, local governments would be required to obtain a permit from the Iowa Department of Transportation to place an automated traffic enforcement cameras on any Iowa road. Existing cameras would be allowed to continue operation until October 1, but local governments must obtain an Iowa DOT permit to continue them beyond that point. When applying for a permit, the local authority would be required to provide supporting data, including traffic and crash figures that illustrate why a traffic camera is needed in that location. Cameras could be used to cite only drivers who fail to yield or stop at a traffic signal-controlled intersection or railroad crossing, or who exceed the speed limit by more than 10 miles per hour. Local authorities would be required to review and approve a record of the alleged traffic violation captured by a traffic camera before a citation is issued. Cedar Rapids, among other cities, already meets the requirement. Cities with a population of 20,000 or less would be prohibited from issuing fines from violations observed by mobile automated traffic enforcement cameras, equipment installed in a vehicle or trailer parked along a shoulder. Those cities could issue only warnings for violations observed by mobile devices. Local governments would be required to spend post-installation and maintenance revenue from traffic camera citations on transportation infrastructure projects or police or fire department operation. Of the 10 cities for which the Legislative Services Agency was able to acquire traffic camera usage data, 6 send traffic camera ticket revenue to the city's general fund, including Cedar Rapids. Cedar Rapids says revenue from its traffic cameras is directed to public safety and was budgeted in fiscal 2023 to fund 33 officer positions, as well as for law enforcement programs and equipment, such as maintenance of police body cameras. Waterloo sends its traffic camera ticket revenue to the general fund to be used for police equipment. Buffalo puts its money toward public safety, Muscatine toward police personnel, and Des Moines to its public safety radio system, and the Iowa statewide interoperable communications system. Those who have sought to ban automatic traffic cameras say their use violates constitutional due process. This bill was a good first step. However, it is still my belief that traffic enforcement cameras are unconstitutional and a money grab, Senator Brad Zahn, a Republican from Urbandale, who has led the charge on traffic camera legislation in previous years, told the Gazette. Zahn voted in favor of the bill, which passed the Senate on a near unanimous 46-1 vote. It previously passed the House 85-12. Mike Klimisch, a Republican from Spillville, who was the town's mayor for 22 years, said during Senate debate that he believes the legislation establishes a very robust regulatory framework that requires local governments to justify the need for traffic cameras. Reynolds' office did not respond to a request for comment on the legislation. This year, in an attempt to secure enough votes to pass this legislation, Zahn combined his proposed traffic camera ban with a proposal that drivers use only hands-free technology when operating a mobile device, a provision that is highly sought by law enforcement officials. That combination upset some Iowans, including advocates for the hand-free requirement, who want to see it passed into law. Law enforcement officials have asked lawmakers in recent years to pass legislation to ban handheld use of mobile devices while driving in Iowa. Officers say the state's prohibition on texting while driving, enacted in 2017, is difficult to enforce because drivers can say they were instead making a call or using the device's GPS, which is still allowed under Iowa law. A proposed hands-free requirement, Senate File 547, overwhelmingly passed the Iowa Senate last year, but the House hit the brakes. Despite data showing the dangers of phone use while driving, Representative Brian Best, a Republican from Glidden, who chairs the House Transportation Committee, said there are not enough votes among House Republicans to pass the bill in the GOP-controlled chamber. "I'm disappointed. I wish we could have done something with it, but it's just not going to happen this year," Best said. "Maybe next year, with retirements, maybe there will be some different ideologies that come in that might support it. But I think there's a group that kind of felt like there was an infringement on the rights of drivers to be picked up for just having a phone in your hand." Best, who is not running for re-election, said he believes pressure is mounting to eventually pass a hands-free requirement. "I hope it doesn't take some type of huge tragedy to get everybody on board," he said. Also on the front page, this story by Grace King, "Advocates call for broader access to food aid." Every time HACAP Food Reservoir's Assistant Director Angie Albright visits a food pantry, she meets someone who has never been to one before. "That says a lot," says Albright, speaking Monday at a roundtable discussion on food insecurity, organized by Representative Sammy Sheets, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids. Some food pantries that partner with HACAP, which is Hawkeye Area Community Action Program, a local nonprofit in eastern Iowa that's dedicated to improving the lives of families and individuals, have seen a 100% increase in the number of people needing assistance, she said. "Every time you're going to see a person who's never been in this situation before. We are in support of any policy that is helping our community as long as that policy is allocating resources responsibly, said Albright, one of five panelists at the discussion held at the downtown Cedar Rapids Public Library. About 40 people attended. Panelists advocated for increasing the number of Iowans eligible for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, called SNAP, and programs that would make available locally grown fruits and vegetables for low-income individuals. Panelist Aries Colbert, president of the Cedar Rapids Education Association and equity coach in the Cedar Rapids Community School District, said she would be in favor of the creation of a Hunger-Free Students Bill of Rights, which would require every school in the state to provide a federally reimbursable meal or snack to students who requested it, regardless of their ability to pay, or if they owe money for earlier meals or snacks. Colbert, who used to be a middle school teacher, said she frequently saw students who didn't have access to a lunch avoid the lunchroom altogether to not feel ashamed for having a school lunch debt. Research indicates students who struggle with food insecurity don't make growth in reading and math. It's hard to concentrate when basic needs aren't being met, Colbert said. Many of her colleagues are digging into their own pockets to provide snacks to children in their classrooms, Colbert said. It's hard to educate a hungry child. Panelist Mugisha Gloyer, executive director and founder of United We March Forward, a nonprofit that provides resources and support for immigrants and refugees, said food insecurity can be particularly challenging for immigrant families who don't qualify for state food assistance. Food security, or insecurity, is a policy choice our state government is making every single day, Sheets said. There are tools available to lawmakers to create access to food for more families, he said. Under a bill passed by Iowa Republican lawmakers and signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds last year, new requirements were added for Iowans receiving public assistance benefits, including an asset test and regular checks to determine their eligibility for programs. Sheets called the bill mean-spirited, saying that it threatened to kick thousands of families off receiving SNAP benefits. At the time the measure was being considered last year in the legislature, Republicans said requiring Iowans who are receiving public assistance benefits to undergo more rigorous eligibility verification reviews would bolster program efficiency, prevent fraud, and weed out abuse. Cindy Feister, chronic disease service coordinator and registered nurse at Linn County Public Health, said food insecurity has long-term impacts on public health. Without adequate resources, people resort to cheap calories that can lead to obesity and chronic illnesses like type 2 diabetes, diet-related cancers, and high blood pressure, she said. Every 3 years, Linn County Public Health publishes a community health improvement plan based on a needs assessment. Feister said for the last 20 years, the top two priority areas for Linn County Public Health are obesity and mental health. The third priority shifts between social determinants of health, such as food insecurity and community safety. Feister mentioned programs such as VeggieRx, which provides access to locally grown fruits and vegetables for low-income people facing diet-related health issues. Another program she mentioned was Double Up Food Bucks, a SNAP incentive program that matches purchases of fruits and vegetables at Iowa grocery stores, farmers markets, and other locations. For every $1 spent on any fresh fruits and vegetables with a SNAP debit card, the family gets $1 in Double Up Food Bucks to spend for more fresh fruits and vegetables. Linn County Public Health is working hard to restore some of its programs that were halted at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic to avoid in-person gatherings, Feister said. One of these programs is the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's National Diabetes Prevention Program, which can help people prevent or delay type 2 diabetes by promoting lifestyle changes. HACAP's Food Reservoir distributes over 10 million meals annually through partner organizations in 7 counties. Over the last few years, HACAP has gone from spending $100,000 annually on food to supplement what it receives from federal programs and donations to spending nearly that much on food, $80,000, in just 1 month. Albright said a large part of the work is understanding the community and being in places with the highest need, whether that's community centers, churches, or schools, or bringing food directly into neighborhoods with mobile food pantries. When visiting a food pantry recently, Albright said she met a woman in her 80s who told her she is eating one meal a day to get by because she can't afford more. She doesn't eat meat anymore because it's too expensive, Albright said. A single man without children told Albright he used to come to the food pantry once a year around the holidays so he would have a little extra money to buy his nieces and nephews nice gifts. Now he's there once a week because he doesn't have enough money to buy groceries, Albright said. If you're a person who has never been in need, if you walk into a food pantry, you're going to learn quickly these are not unhoused individuals or people without jobs, although we do serve the unhoused and people without jobs. The bulk of people using these services are just like the people sitting in this room, especially in today's economy, Albright said. Turning now to the Iowa Today page, Cedar Rapids nonprofit that helped teens finish school, closing. This by Grace King. A local nonprofit that provides one-on-one mentoring to students in the Cedar Rapids Community School District is closing its doors at the end of the school year because of lack of funding. Empowering Youths of Iowa has helped dozens of students graduate high school since it was founded in June 2021. The main financial contributor to Empowering Youths of Iowa was the Cedar Rapids School District. But the partnership is being ended as the founder of Empowering Youths of Iowa, Sarah Swayze, also seeks to open a charter school this fall. We should never have been in the position of depending on Cedar Rapids schools anyway, Swayze said. Funding is one reason why, Swayze said, she is planning to open a charter school. I don't want to have to fight so much for finances, she said. Charter schools are tuition-free schools families can voluntarily enroll in that are publicly funded but independently run under an approved charter within the state. In Iowa, charter schools receive per-pupil state aid. Initially, Swayze hoped that the nonprofit could continue operating apart from the charter school. The Cedar Rapids District and Empowering Youths of Iowa mutually agreed to end their partnership due to EYI, or Empowering Youths of Iowa, transitioning to a charter school, according to a statement from the district. It is impossible to overstate how grateful we are for everything you and the others at EYI have done for so many students and their families, and we wish you success in your new venture. We will certainly stay alert to any future changes that reveal new opportunities for the district and your organization to collaborate, Cedar Rapids Superintendent Tawana Grover said in an email to the Gazette. During the 2022-23 school year, the Cedar Rapids School District awarded Empowering Youths of Iowa $125. For the 2023-24 school year, the organization was awarded $62,500 from the district, with an additional $40,000 for summer programming. The school district regularly partners with community organizations that help to provide needed services to students and staff. Empowering Youths of Iowa has been one of those partners for the past several years and is currently working with 122 Cedar Rapids students. Since the pandemic, the district has used federal pandemic relief dollars, the American Rescue Plan Elementary and Secondary School Relief, to provide extra funding to community partners, spokesman Justin Schaefer said in an email to the Gazette. This funding expires in September. Schaefer also attributed a decrease in school funding to all community partners to the increase of only 2.5% in state aid by the legislature. Also on the Iowa Today page, about 100 trees removed for a new road on the UI campus, this by Aaron Jordan. Some University of Iowa employees are angry campus planners decided to cut down about 100 trees to make way for a new road without warning faculty, staff, and students. The first new road on campus in at least a decade, the 1,500-foot artery and a connected roundabout will link Newton Road and the fountain entrance of the UI hospitals and clinics. This project will make way for construction of a new inpatient tower, the UI told the Gazette last fall. But putting in new pavement means the UI had to remove or relocate 126 trees in March, as chainsaws buzzed, many UI employees watched with surprise and dismay. We're saddened by the College of Medicine's decision to cut a grove of 70-plus healthy, diverse, new and old growth trees over spring break for temporary earth mover access and new roadways, according to a letter employees plan to send the UI this week. This decision was made without transparent communication with stakeholders, the group of medical and public health students, staff, faculty, and emeritus faculty want to be involved in future decisions about removals of trees, which provide shade, reduce stress for humans who walk nearby, and provide habitat for animals. We will collaborate with the UI Office of Sustainability and UI Administration to work towards creating a stronger process for stakeholder involvement and transparency, with the initial goal of at least two stakeholder meetings regarding ongoing and future development plans, the letter states. Of the 126 trees located on the site of the new roadway, 23 were moved to other locations across the main campus and Oakdale campus. Director of UI Office of Sustainability and Environment said in a prepared statement, planners who altered the road design to preserve three large oak trees, UI arborists said would be difficult to replace. About 100 trees were removed, but will be replaced with new trees in this area or elsewhere on campus. The University of Iowa prioritizes the preservation and care of trees on our campus and plants about 300 new trees every year, the spokesperson said. Whenever a tree needs to be removed due to health concerns, natural disasters, or campus development, we ensure that 2 to 3 trees are planted elsewhere on campus. The campus is home to more than 8,000 trees and has been officially recognized as a Level 2 accredited arboretum through ArbNet. Crews will plant 86 trees on the site of the road construction project, which is expected to be substantially complete by fall. The location of the remaining tree plantings will be determined once design work for the new inpatient tower is completed in 2026. A UI website providing details about the road project says construction would be started this spring and would include relocation of utilities. It does not mention tree removal. The projection cost of the road project is $17.5 million. Employees critical of the way tree removal was handled said they strongly support development of a new inpatient tower. The $1 billion tower will be built just west of UIHC, where parking ramp 1 and the Wendell Johnson Speech and Hearing Center are located. The tower will include multiple floors of inpatient beds for adult care, as well as an inpatient surgery area, space for pathology, radiology, and pharmacy, and a public space at the top with views of Kinnick Stadium. Also in Iowa News, this by Emily Anderson. A 13-year-old girl was found dead Sunday in Eldora after police responded to a report that a person had been shot, according to the Iowa Department of Public Safety. Police placed a 12-year-old boy in custody after arriving at the scene. The Eldora Police Department and the Hardin County Sheriff's Office responded at 5:27 p.m. on Sunday to the 800 block of 12th Street in Eldora for a report of a shooting. The 13-year-old girl was found dead, according to a news release from the department. The release didn't explain the boy's role in the death or what charges he faces. The identities of the two minors have not been released. The Public Safety Department's Division of Criminal Investigation was called to assist with the investigation, which is ongoing. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest column today by Adam Zabner is titled, Iowa Hinders Voter Registration. American democracy is at its best when Americans participate. Unfortunately, Iowa's Department of Health and Human Services is holding some Iowans back from participating in our elections. In 1993, Congress, with bipartisan support from Iowa's federal delegation, passed the National Voter Registration Act to encourage participation. The NVRA is the reason you are asked to register to vote every time you renew your Iowa driver's license. The bill also requires Americans to be given a chance to register to vote every time they register or renew their registration for Medicaid. Nationally, the NVRA has been a roaring success. In particular, the provisions around Medicaid have helped improve voter registration rates among low-income Americans and people of color, groups that have historically been underrepresented in elections and in government. In January, the Iowa Capital Dispatch reported that Iowa is failing to comply with the NVRA. In the last election cycle, just 1,222 Iowans registered to vote through public assistance programs. Compared that number to Kentucky, where 88,000 people were able to register. The Capital Dispatch reported that these voter registrations accounted for 0.1% of new applicants in Iowa, compared to a national average of 3%. It's not hard to guess what explains these lackluster numbers. Iowa's Medicaid application form is 27 pages long. Many other states include a voter registration form in the packet. In Iowa, at the bottom of page 16, the packet contains one sentence and a link to the voter registration form. The link is printed out. An Iowan would have to type the 46-character link into their browser and access a printer to print it out. This is unlikely to register voters, and states with similar policies have been found to be out of compliance with the NVRA. In January, I met with Iowa Health and Human Services Director Kelly Garcia and brought this issue to her attention. Despite repeated assurances that the agency wants to improve, the department has failed to act. Iowa can and must do better to ensure access to voting rights for every eligible Iowan. People applying for or renewing their Medicaid should simply receive a printed out voter registration form to return. The agency must act, and it must act soon. Iowans are facing what could be the most important election in American history, and voting access can't wait one more day. That's signed today, or submitted today, by State Representative Adam Zabner, who is a Democrat from Iowa City. The guest column today by Bruce Lear, lawmakers have done enough damage. It's after midnight. You've yawned and stretched. You've heard the same story twice. There's no move to leave. They're settled in. You pick up the plates, bottles, and cans and say, I've got an early day tomorrow. But they've one more story to tell. We've all been in this situation. They're your friends and you don't want to offend, but they've overstayed. Your instinct is to yell, go home. But friendship demands patience. The majority party in the Iowa legislature and the governor, based on what they've done recently, are not my friends. I feel comfortable shouting, go home. You've done enough damage. Both political parties need to be called out when they're not listening and are damaging the basic values. Republicans are guilty of this. The Republican Party at one time preached a small government, little intrusion doctrine. They scoffed at the nanny state. What we didn't realize was the scoffing turned to cheering once they got to hire the nanny. Now intrusion is common and they've no time for listening. It's hard to list all the ways they've wielded unchecked power, but here are a few public education examples. The school community is diverse. It's comprised of parents, support staff, school board members, administrators, teachers, and community leaders. It's hard to get consensus on many issues. But one issue the school community agreed on was protecting area education agencies. If the governor insisted on change, the education community agreed there should be a comprehensive study with all stakeholders involved as decision makers. Instead, Republicans rammed through a 49-page bill that few had read and most Iowans opposed. Those 49 pages included surprises and mistakes. Governor Kim Reynolds refused to correct any mistakes. She smugly said, "I'm absolutely not open to tweaking the AEA law." The teacher salary bill is long overdue, but instead of listening, they log rolled it into the AEA Destruction Act. They did it so they could run attack ads labeling Democrats who voted against it as anti-teacher. It's cynical and false, but you'll see it in October. The party that moans about the economy shortchanged public schools by providing a 2.5% increase in state aid. Local schools are busy cutting staff now. There's more to come. The Senate just passed an amended version of HF 2586 and sent it back to the House. That's the bill allowing school personnel to be armed and ties to force school districts with an enrollment of over 8,000 students to hire school resource officers or security guards for every building housing grades 9 to 12, unless the school board votes against it. Creating a school environment with guns is asking for trouble. Insurance companies willing to cover districts will raise premiums to cover higher risk. Kids will know who is armed and where the guns are stored. It's time for legislators to clean their desks, say goodbye to colleagues, and go home. They've done enough damage. It's also time for voters to provide some checks and balance in November. Bruce Lear, who lives in Sioux City, taught for 11 years and represented educators as an Iowa State Education Association regional director for 27 years until retiring. One community letter today is titled, "Iowa City Board Focuses on Money in Closing, Hills Elementary." With a bit less than 1,000 residents, Hills is a small Iowa city. I'm saddened by the Iowa City School District's vote to shutter the doors of this Blue Ribbon School, a national program that recognizes public and private elementary, middle, and high schools based on their overall academic excellence or their progress in closing achievement gaps among student subgroups. Closing this school is a cruel blow to Hills, a tight-knit community where students face more barriers than any other school in the district. 81% of Hills students get free or reduced-price lunch. 66% are non-white or multiracial. 40% are English language learners, and 9% are homeless. The discussion, focused solely on money, amounted to the school board saying, "The students will be okay in their new schools," as if being appended from a comfort zone provided by teachers, friends, and community is secondary to money. School board members say the children will be fine, but when did these folks become child psychologists? I know children are resilient, but they need their community. It has been the board's intention for a number of years to close Hills, but they have not been transparent about it, hiding behind meaningless excuses that kept Hills from getting the resources necessary for the school to grow as the community grows. The greater community did little to advocate for Hills. Once they got everything they wanted, with the $191.5 million bond referendum, Hills was relegated to the dustbin of irrelevancy. That letter is signed by Carol DeProse of Iowa City. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette today on IRIS, Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We turn now to the obituary page, beginning with the short notices. First from Belle Plain, Donald, known as Gene, Eugene Vandivier, 89, died Sunday, April 14, Rabbit Newhouse Funeral Service. In Cedar Rapids, Louis Roman, age 87, died Sunday, April 14, Bross Chapel in the Abba Center. In Delmar, Darcy Lynn Edwards, 77, died Friday, April 12, Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. From Delmar, Eugene, known as Gene Larry, age 78, died Saturday, April 13. Again, Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. From Independence, John E. Kortenkamp, 66, died Saturday, April 13. White Funeral Home is in charge. In Olwine, Marlene I. Gibbs, age 92, died Saturday, April 13. Jameson Schmidt's Funeral Home. Also in Olwine, Randy L. Graff, age 66, of Apache Junction, Arizona, formerly of Olwine, died Friday, March 29, Jameson Schmidt's funeral home. In Harper, Marjorie Clarahan, 95, died Sunday, April 14, Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Kyoto. In Maquoketa, Gloria Wilhelm, age 81, died Sunday, April 14, Carson Celebration of Life Center. In Shellsburg, Walter Bruce, age 89, died Monday, April 15, Phillips Funeral Home in Vinton. In Monticello, Daniel W. Porter, 72, died Thursday, March 28. Kramer Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. In Wadena, Dolores M. Bohm, age 97, died Saturday, April 13. Jameson Schmidt's Funeral Home, Arlington. And in Waukon, Chester Schleicke, age 85, died Saturday, April 13. Martin Grau Funeral Home is in charge. Turning now to the regular notices. From Independence, Charles H. Werner, Sr., age 86, of Independence, formerly of Winthrop, died Saturday, April 13th at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. Charles was born on December 6, 1937 in rural Walker, Iowa, the son of Harry H. and Tracy K. Novak Werner. He attended the rural country schools and the Quasquetine Elementary School. In 1956, Charles graduated from Winthrop High School. He not only got a diploma from school, but also found the love of his life, Nancy Jo. They were married August 3, 1957, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Winthrop. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, April 17th at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Winthrop. Burial will be at St. Patrick's Cemetery. Visitation will be held on Tuesday from 4 p.m. until 7:30 at the Reef Family Center, Funeral Home and Crematory in Independence. A rosary led by the Knights of Columbus will be said at 3:45 p.m. at the funeral home on Tuesday. To leave an online condolence, please go to reeffamilycenter.com. In Iowa City, Dr. Jimmy Randolph Pinkham, age 79, died Saturday, April 13th at home, surrounded by his family. The family will greet friends Thursday, April 18th from 4 to 6 at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. Interment will be later at Oakland Cemetery. Jimmy was born on March 26, 1945 in Raleigh, North Carolina, the son of Jesse R. and Margaret Strickland Pinkham. As an adult, he managed to build both a pleasant life and a successful career in Iowa City amongst the Yankees. He married Alicia Smith from 1971 to 1977, and he was married to Carol Sloniker from 1979 until her death in 2014. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made in support of the University of Iowa College of Dentistry Pediatric Excellence Fund. Checks should be mailed to University of Iowa Center for Advancement, P.O. Box 4550 in Iowa City, 52244. And on the memo line, or a note attached, please indicate gift in memory of Dr. Jimmy Pinkham. From Solon, Joyce King Barta, age 78, passed away on April 13, surrounded by her family. She was born April 11, 1946, in Brooklyn, Iowa, the daughter of Lester and Edna King. She graduated from Brooklyn High School and was united in marriage to Richard Barta on May 10, 1968, in Brooklyn. Visitation will be on Thursday, April 18th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Solon. Funeral Mass will be held on Friday, April 19th, at 10 a.m. at St. Mary's. Burial will be in Oakland Cemetery, Solon, and a luncheon will follow. Memorials may be given to Solon Community Food Pantry. Online condolences are encouraged at roschchapel.com. In Cedar Rapids, Thomas, known as Tom Eugene Redden, age 77, passed away Sunday, April 14, at home. Visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, April 18th at the Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, 2121 Bowling Street, Southwest. Funeral Mass will be at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, April 19th at St. Ludmilla, followed by military rites. burial will be in Calvary Cemetery, Cascade. Thomas was born November 30, 1946, in Monticello, the son of Charles and Doris Emerson Redden. He graduated from Western Dubuque High School, the class of 1964, and served in the United States Army during the Vietnam War from 1965 to 1971. Memorials are suggested to the Legacy of Faith, St. Ludmilla, or the Disabled American Veterans in his name. Online condolences are welcome at brosschapel.com. From Marion, Mary Jo Smith, 85, passed away March 2. She was a beautiful soul, proud, accomplished, full of love, courage, and strength, and always accepted what came her way with grace and dignity by holding on to her Catholic faith that the things happened the way they should, not always the way she wanted them. Mary Jo was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the daughter of Clarence and Nellie Mercer. The Mercer family lived on a farm in Springville at the time. Mary Jo was the only daughter with three brothers, Richard, Robert, and James. Funeral Mass will be held at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion on Friday, April 19th at 10:30 a.m., with visitation 1 hour prior to the service. Interment will follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Memorials in Mary Jo's name and memory may be directed to the Cedar Valley Humane Society. Please share a memory at murdochfuneralhome.com. From Olin, Merle Rickles, age 77, passed away at home Sunday, April 14th in Olin. Military honors will be conducted at 9:30 a.m. on Friday, April 19th at the Olin Cemetery. Merle was born April 17th, 1946, on the family farm in Center Junction, Iowa, son to Clarence and Martha Benkin Rickles. Merle earned his high school diploma while serving two tours in Vietnam in the Marines, honorably discharged in July of 1970. Please share your support and memories with Merle's family on his tribute wall at stuartbaxter.com. From Cedar Rapids, Robert Wenzel Blazik, age 87, passed away Saturday, April 13th at his home. Bob was born April 16th, 1936 in Cedar Rapids, the son of Frank and Philomena Blazik. He married Geraldine Turner May 31st, 1958 in Cedar Rapids and served our country in the United States Army from 1958 to 1960. Visitation will be held on Wednesday, April 17th from 1 to 3 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids, with a memorial service to follow at 3 p.m. Interment will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids. Memorials may be directed to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, P.O. Box 1999 in Memphis, Tennessee, 38101. Online condolences are welcome at cedarmemorial.com. In Cedar Rapids, Jeffrey, known as Jeff Jasper, passed away at the age of 67. Funeral services will be held Wednesday, April 17th at Bethany Lutheran Church, beginning at 11 with a visitation prior, beginning at 10. Burial will take place at a later date. Jeff is the son of Lawrence and Mary Francis Jasper, born January 10, 1957, in Hopkinton, Iowa. The family would like to give special thanks to Dr. Mary Ann Nelson, as well as the nurses and physicians that cared for Jeff at Mercy Medical Center. Memorials are suggested to Mercy Medical Center Foundation, 701 10th Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids, 52403. Condolences can be left at cedarmemorial.com. Final obituary, Claudette A. Schaefer from Iowa City, age 89, longtime resident, died Saturday, April 13, surrounded by family under hospice care. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. on Thursday, April 18th at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Iowa City, burial to follow at Memory Gardens Cemetery in Iowa City. Visitation will be from 4:30 to 7 Wednesday at Gay and Gia Funeral and Cremation Service. A rosary will be shared beginning at 4:30. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be made in her memory to St. Mary's Catholic Church. For a complete obituary or to share a thought, memory, or condolence, please visit the Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service website. Turning now to the sports page, there are no high school sports stories today. Not surprisingly, the highlight of the sports page, no surprise, Fever make Iowa's Clark number one. This story by Jeff Linder. She elevated the University of Iowa women's basketball program to unprecedented heights. Caitlin Clark's new mission is to help lift a professional franchise toward respectability. She will do it in, perhaps, the most basketball-crazed state in the nation. As expected, Clark was the Indiana Fever's selection as the number one pick in the WNBA draft last night at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in Brooklyn, New York. "I'm ready for this chapter in my life," Clark said on ESPN's pre-draft telecast. "I'm ready to be an adult." A 6-foot point guard from West Des Moines, Clark is the most prolific scorer in NCAA history, scoring 3,951 career points. She ranked third on the women's career assist chart with 1,144. "Sometimes people overlook my passing," Clark said. "They look at my scoring, and don't get me wrong, I love to put the ball in the basket. Once I get playing with my teammates, they can read me, read my eyes." She was a 3-time first-team All-American by the Associated Press and named National Player of the Year twice by most major award services after leading the Hawkeyes to NCAA runner-up finishes in 2023 and 24 and 3 Big Ten tournament titles. Under the WNBA salary structure, the number one pick will earn $76,535 this season. Iowa finished 34-5 in 2023-24 and was a massive draw at home, on the road, and on TV. The Hawkeyes' national championship loss to South Carolina was viewed by an average of 18.7 million viewers, by far a record for women's basketball. In Indianapolis, Clark will be tasked with igniting a similar interest in the Fever, whose last postseason appearance was in 2016. Indiana was 10th in the 12-team league last season in win-loss records and 11th in attendance, with 4,067 per game. But judging by ticket prices, both in Indianapolis and for the Fever's road games, Clark's appeal will be league-wide immediately. 36 of the Fever's 40 games will be televised nationally for the 2024 season, which begins May 14 in Connecticut. The first home game is May 16 at Gainbridge Fieldhouse. Indiana's preseason games are May 3rd at Dallas and May 10 at home versus Atlanta. Clark will join a roster that includes former Ohio State star Kelsey Mitchell and Aaliyah Boston, whose South Carolina team the Hawkeyes beat in the national semifinals in 2023. Aaliyah was the number one draft pick last year. A member of the WNBA since 2000, Indiana won the league championship in 2012 and was the runner-up in 2009 and 2015. In sports of area interest today in high school track, Marion and Regina are at the Solon Invitational at 4:15. In boys soccer, Linmar is at Prairie, Washington at Xavier, Liberty at Kennedy, Iowa City West is at Jefferson today, Dubuque Senior at City High, and Marion is at Kirk Creek Amana. In girls soccer, Prairie is at Linmar, Kennedy at Liberty, Jefferson at Iowa City West, Clear Creek Amana is at Marion, Hudson at Regina, and City High at Dubuque Senior. Boys tennis has Jefferson at Kennedy at 4 p.m., Linmar at Prairie, Liberty at Iowa City West, and Marion Seidel at South Tama. And girls tennis will find Prairie at Linmar, Jefferson at Kennedy, Iowa City West plays at Liberty, and South Tama is at Marion. If you're listening on the radio, the Cubs play at the Diamondbacks at 8:30, that broadcast at KXIC. And turning now to the Things to Do column, in the music category, Key Change Series number 7, in this series presented by Orchestra Iowa and the UI School of Music, gives musicians a live performance opportunity. Opus Concert Cafe hosts, and that is at 6 to 8 p.m. today. A $10 donation is suggested. Turning now to the top weather story, this by Hannah Messier. Severe weather safety is the title of this column today. As we continue through severe weather season, it's important to know how to stay safe when storms develop. First, make sure you download the KCRG TV9 First Alert weather app to get the latest information about warnings as storms roll through our region. Next, make sure you have everything you need for you and your family in a disaster supply kit. A few things to include are water, non-perishable food, medications, a flashlight and batteries, cell phone chargers, a first aid kit, and a whistle to signal for help. If a tornado warning is issued for your area, a safe place to go is an interior room on the lowest level of your house. And looking at the weather for today, we are expecting some storms this afternoon. Wind out of the southeast at 20, gusting to over 40 miles an hour. We're looking for a high today of 70 degrees in Cedar Rapids, 72 in Iowa City. That's well above our normal high, which is 60 degrees. The normal low is 38. A record high of 94 degrees was set in 1896. A record low of 17 was set in 1949. Looking at the weather for the rest of the week, chance of showers and windy again tomorrow and Thursday. Mostly cloudy skies on Friday. And our temperatures, a high tomorrow of 65, dipping into the mid-50s by the end of the week. Sunset tonight is at 7:49 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow at 6:22 a.m. That gives us 13 hours and 25 minutes of daylight. And we are in the first quarter of the moon phase, with moonrise at 12:42 p.m. and set at 3:58 a.m. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a copy of today's reading anytime on Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. Thanks for listening and have a great, safe day.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. With half a dozen measles outbreaks currently underway in the U.S., as well as several serious international outbreaks, the news on measles vaccine from Denmark is important. Researchers conducted a nationwide study that included everyone born between 1999 and 2010. With more than 650,000 children in that group, they had more than 5 million person-years of follow-up. The Danish health system keeps excellent records on all of its citizens, including the children. Consequently, the scientists are confident that the 6,517 children diagnosed with autism during the study period are all the children who developed this condition. Children who did not receive the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, or MMR, were equally likely as vaccinated children to develop autism. The investigators conclude, the study strongly supports that MMR vaccination does not increase the risk for autism, does not trigger autism in susceptible children, and is not associated with clustering of autism cases after vaccination.
The Food and Drug Administration has just approved a completely new type of antidepressant. The nasal spray, called esketamine, is expected to help people who have not responded to standard antidepressants. It will be marketed under the brand name Spravato. This drug is chemically related to the injectable anesthetic ketamine that's been on the market since 1970 and is available generically. Although S-ketamine is administered as a nasal spray, people will not be permitted to purchase it for home use. They will need to use Spravato under medical supervision at a clinic or doctor's office. Some experts have challenged the FDA's approval process for S-ketamine. While two clinical trials demonstrated some benefit, two others did not show that S-ketamine is better than placebo. Side effects of this novel antidepressant include nausea, dizziness, headache, and a feeling of dissociation.
FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb unexpectedly announced his departure from the agency this week. Experts were puzzled by his announcement since he has received high marks from the administration, industry, and even some consumer groups. Dr. Gottlieb has raised questions about teen vaping and has been an outspoken critic of pharmacy chains that sell tobacco products to minors. Some commentators speculate that these stances might be related to his abrupt departure. His explanation for the sudden departure is that he wants to spend more time with his wife and young children. Dr. Gottlieb is a survivor of Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Another week, another drug recall. Many lots of ARB blood pressure drugs, including losartan, valsartan, and irbesartan, have been recalled over the past 8 months. These medicines were contaminated with potential carcinogens known as NDMA and NDEA. Now, Hetero Labs has recalled 87 lots, and Tarrant Pharmaceuticals Limited is recalling 100 lots of losartan tablets. These pills contain an entirely new contaminant just identified as NMBA. It, too, is a suspected carcinogen. All three of these nitrosamine contaminants are apparently created as a result of the manufacturing process. FDA Commissioner Gottlieb stated, "We're making important strides at understanding how these impurities form, and we're continuing to examine if nitrosamine impurities may also arise during the manufacture of other ARB drug products. The FDA is committed to implementing measures to prevent the formation of these impurities during drug manufacturing processes in the future."
Cocoa flavonoids may have some benefit for people with multiple sclerosis, according to a small study. Previous research showed that dark chocolate rich in cocoa compounds might improve symptoms of chronic fatigue. The investigators recruited 40 people with relapsing remitting MS to drink cocoa every day for 6 weeks. 19 of them got high flavonoid cocoa, while 21 drank low flavonoid cocoa. At the end of the study, those on the high flavonoid cocoa had slightly less fatigue and could walk somewhat farther in 6 minutes than they had at the outset. They also reported less pain. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.